D1.
Number 21, B.
Therefore, she said of her students, my first students could not be representative Christian scientists. One just can feel how she must have struggled with the duty, with the mission that she felt she had to accomplish. There was that ability to heal through the Spirit, through the influx of truth, and then feeling the inability to explain the modus operandi of this Spirit. She says, when contemplating the majesty and magnitude of this query, it looked as if centuries of spiritual growth were requisite to enable me to elucidate or to demonstrate what I had discovered. She just felt that which so often each one of us may feel, that we have touched something and just feel, oh, a lifetime is not long enough to accomplish it. Takes longer, takes more. Can I ever do it? And this was her attitude too at that point. Then we know that the circumstances forced her to start somewhere, to start with a pupil, with one pupil, to start to teach a pupil. And by teaching and by finding out the mistakes the pupils made, little by little, she could generalize her endeavors into finding at least one method that would meet the need of the day. Namely, we come now to the fourth period, the period of argumentation. Argumentation as a healing method of the student, not as a healing method for her. That must be quite clear. The big question was, as she says in miscellaneous writing, if a divine principle alone heals, what is the human modus for demonstrating it? How could that divine be somehow reconciled with a human modus? My students at first, she says, practiced in slightly differing forms. Although I could heal mentally without a sign, save the immediate recovery of the sick, my students, patients, and people generally called for a sign, a material evidence wherewith to satisfy the sick, and something was being done for them. And I said, suffer it to be so now. Students first began to treat and argue with outward signs, with manipulation. Experience, she says, however, taught me the impossibility of demonstrating the signs of metaphysical healing by any outward form of practice. We know from the biographies that the first students healed really very similar to Quimby, that they too manipulated the patient, that they too wetted their hand in water, then wrapped the skull of the patient and argued the truth about the case, just as Quimby did. And we know that this brought about a great controversy with Mrs. Eddy, that these students who went through class with Mrs. Eddy said, well, what is true? Here we are taught how to heal the patient through manipulation, and you teach us that all is spirit. And so in 1872, she had to drop manipulation and went even as far 3 years later when she wrote her first textbook that she said, "One who manipulates is a traitor to science." You see the changes she went through so quickly. First teaching manipulate, all right, suffer it to be so now. And then after a few years say, now drop it. And then a few years later saying, well, really what you have done is, what you say, betraying science. So the method of argumentation was really given for the students. She herself says in the Divinity Course, "I never argued until I began teaching students, and I had to meet the thought where it stood." So you see, argumentation was really bending down to that point where the students could catch it. First, she taught audible argumentation, that the student would argue with loud voice what he has to argue for. Then very soon she asked for silent argumentation. What is the method of argumentation? Argumentation is really a very hard job because it has to take in practically every suggestion against the case. And we know that the mortal mind is very prolific in having suggestions for evil. So, as she began to teach argumentation, one could see that year after year, the list of arguments that had to be brought into a treatment became bigger and bigger and bigger, until after about 10 or 15 years, we had texts of argumentations that went over 2 and 3 printed pages. Because what is the method of arguing? It is the method of affirming the truth and denying error. Usually one would start with God and argue that God is whole, perfect, and that therefore God is not sinful nor sick, that therefore he cannot send sickness, cannot send sin, that he cannot create any disease, therefore that man cannot be sick, sinful, that he cannot have an accident, that sin, sickness, and disease have no cause because God is the only cause, and so that sin, disease, and death are no effects. You just argued right from the point of view of God, but through argumentations. These argumentations would include, at the beginning, the name of a patient. You called the patient by name. You called the disease by name and argued that this person cannot have this and this disease. It would negate all the claims that were put forward about that disease. That the argument would include that the patient cannot be sick, that sickness is not real, that all the symptoms of disease are unreal, that they don't exist, that they have no cause, no power, no substance, no name, no process, no morbidity, that they can have no effect, that they cannot last, that they have no time, and so on. You just argued everything what came into your mind about this disease, and negating all these suggestions. Then naturally affirming that the patient is whole, that he doesn't know any disease, that he knows that he is whole, that he knows that he is well, that he can't be sick, that he is the child of God, and so on. Well, then one would take in into the argument all the testimonies of the physical senses and argue against the testimony of the physical senses, that the patient can't suffer, that he has no sensation, that there is no sensation in matter, therefore that he can't feel the disease, that he can't have fever and the cold and so on, that he can't suffer, that matter cannot inflame, that he cannot feel any inflammation or any irritation or anything like that. And one would just negate the testimony of the physical senses. Then usually the argument would go on to see that the practitioner who argues could not forget anything which is necessary for the treatment. So they would argue further that I cannot forget any point in this argument, that I cannot make to forget anything, to be blind to any argument, that I must know that my treatment is effective, that it cannot be reversed, that it will have its effect, that the patient will react to it, that this treatment contains all the arguments necessary, that the treatment cannot be reversed, and it cannot produce an opposite effect than what I treat the patient for, that the patient can only be blessed by it and can have no ill effect, that the patient knows that he is well, that the law of God includes a law that annuls all the false claims, and so on. On that this treatment is really a very good treatment and a complete treatment and will do the job. Can you see, only through these few indications, I'm not a very good argumentator, you have to see, I had to look into my notes. And apparently at that time the practitioners weren't too good at it either, because they had to write down reams and reams so that they, and check up, did I argue against this, you see? Argue against Roman Catholicism, against spiritualism, against malpractice, arguing against this and that and the other, you see? You checked it off. Oh yes, I have done this for this case. Now, what is really the value and of such an argument? This audible treatment first also was described as verbal argument or oral argument, oral treatment or spoken treatment. Well, you know, there may be occasions where we are quite glad to recur to that treatment. I think if you have a lot of pain, perhaps, that you nearly can't think one straight thought, I think perhaps this is a very good way of treating yourself. Just to stand up and walk the room up and down and just speak aloud to yourself, declaring the truth, because that's the best one can do at that moment. So let's see that as we go on to higher and ever higher methods of treatment, that we may not leave behind the former stages, but that the former stages just take on their right place and not a unique place. From this audible treatment, the argumentation, there was a step to silent argumentation, which is a further mentalization, really, of the audible treatment, a further step to mentalizing treatment. It is a silent affirmation and denial. This was called, the silent argumentation was called addressing the thought. And if one investigates now, retrospectively, what this argumentation really was, the structure of it, we could see now that they already touched in some way the four sides of the holy city. They had already a touch of the word in it, because that method was to address the mentality of the patient, calling him by name. It was first the word and addressing it, and calling him by name and arguing the truth, stating, the word is a statement, giving a statement of the truth. Why? Because there was that belief, the Christ, a touch of the Christ, that the practitioner would thereby project his thoughts of truth to the mentality of the patient. See, it was thought transference, some slight touch of the Christ, message from God to man. And a sense of Christianity, they did that because thereby they believed that they would correct the thought of the patient, and to correct the mistaken thinking of the patient by substituting it with the practitioner's concept of truth. And you had a sense, a touch of that third side of the holy city. And the whole thing had a touch of the fourth side, namely that this transfer of thought from one human mind to the other was really mesmerism, not Christian Science. The science of mesmerism. Yes. Every thought transference is mesmerism. And by golly, Mrs. Eddy had to watch for 20 years, 30 years, how that mesmerism was practiced under the name of Christian Science. It is said that Kimball, round about the turning of the century, said to Mrs. Eddy, if she didn't believe that 50% of all the Christian Science treatments were mesmerism, and that Mrs. Eddy smiled and answered, don't you think 2/3? 2/3.
Benevolent sicknesses.
Yes. So that's what it was. You see, that she brought the thought as far as to get the student out of Quimby's mesmerism into really benevolent mesmerism or ignorant mesmerism. And naturally, every benevolent hypnotism, mesmerism, leads finally to ignorant mesmerism, and ignorant mesmerism is very near to malicious mesmerism. So that was the situation round about that time. As this went on, a new concept of arguing came into the picture. So it's like the Christ idea, just pushing and pushing and pushing through the mist of obscurity. And people were asking now, where on earth then does sickness exist? If sickness is mental, does sickness exist in the mind of the patient? Or where? And they began to realize that really they didn't have to treat the patient's erroneous thought, but the practitioner's erroneous thought. That the practitioner really should heal himself of believing what the patient tells him. It is, physician, heal thyself. It wasn't anymore, physician, heal your patient. The practitioner, so to say, must heal himself from the false belief which the patient voices to him. And so you can see it became now impersonal. It took it away from the patient, and it was called impersonal treatment. the practitioner argues away the false beliefs which plagues his world, no more the patient's world. Amos Novel says, the practitioner declares the truth for the sole purpose of clarifying his own thought and to disabuse it of the false beliefs he has accepted in consciousness in consequence of listening to some patient's tale or woe. So at this time, they didn't feel anymore that I have given a good treatment to the patient, but they now feel I have treated myself quite well, and this will heal the sick. So they began to treat themselves instead of the patient, which is, in a way, already hinting to that which we see today, that really the right sense of treatment is that we treat ourselves of our ignorance of the oneness of being in which all is one harmony. We have to get rid of the thought that something is wrong in God's universe. So they began to see that if I be lifted up from the earth, that will draw all men unto me. That if we lift consciousness high enough, that this will heal the sick. So this did away with thought transference, with transference of thought power, transference of thought healing power. Now it was no more a transfer from the practitioner thought on the patient thought. Jesus beheld in science the perfect man, and beholding this perfect man, that this correct view will heal the sick. And at that time they put into the center, really, of their understanding that which afterwards Bicknell Young repeated quite often, the Christian scientist is alone with his own being and with the reality of all things. So you can see that here we have a further development in argumentation, that now the practitioner argues for himself that he doesn't believe the patient's tale and woe. Now this is the method that perhaps covered that long period since the first edition of Science and Health, 1875, up to the time of Kimball, round about the turning of the centuries. Those 25 years were mostly recognizable through that method of treating by arguments. But naturally, Mrs. Eddy was still working in that big line, how can I spiritualize the patient's thought in order to give him a spiritual method instead of a mental method of healing? It is in that period, round about 1891, when she published the 50th edition of Science and Health, that very remarkable change, where she says quite clearly and puts the proposition right before the reader, she says, remember that the letter and mental argument are only human auxiliaries to aid in bringing thought into accord with the spirit of truth and love, which heals the sick and the sinner. So here she states bluntly, arguing is only an aid to bring thought into accord with the spirit of truth and love. By the truthful arguments you employ, and especially by the spirit of truth and love which you entertain, you will heal the sick. So one can see at that period before the turning of the century how she pinpointed now and said, look here, the argument is all right, but this is only a way of attuning yourself so that you can catch the tone of spirit. If the student, she says, is not perfectly attuned to divine signs, he needs the argument of truth for reminders. But if spirit or the power of divine love bear witness to the truth, this is the ultimatum and the scientific way, and the healing is instantaneous. Can you see how she now tries to lead the thought from argument to the spirit of truth and love? And she makes it also very clear that there is not much power in human thought, and that we have to see that there must be a way out of the mental into the divine mind. Jesus, she said, did not argue with the devil. He said, get thee behind me, Satan. And then, as time went on, at the beginning of this century, Mrs. Eddy became quite strict about this method of arguing and affirming and denial, and said that argumentation can even hinder the work, because through argumentation you make disease more real to one's mind. By constantly fighting disease, you make disease more real in your mind, and therefore it can become a danger. She says, now stop the negations, entreating, and hold to the truth. There is danger of making a reality of your patient's belief by over-anxiety in arguing against it. And when one reads in Divinity Course, especially round about the first years of this century, she says, you do not have to argue. No. No, God and his idea. And not argue about sin. Can you see? At the turning of the century, she brings forward the thought, all is mind and mind's idea. So that if from mental argumentation we arrive to idea, that will bring us out of argumentation into the spiritual method of healing disease. So at that point, she asks really to know the one mind through its ideas. Know mind and his ideas, and don't argue about it. Go out from mind. And you can go out from mind because you have the mind of Christ. And mind knows itself. Not that we have to know the truth about the situation, arguing it out on that basis, but that mind knows itself, that mind knows its own ideas, and that mind knows itself as ideas. And the moment she has touched that and given that to her nearest students, we come into that new period, which we can call the Kimball period, where really the question of idea now comes into focus.